Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're exploring a really influential, fascinating religious movement from the past, Manichaeism.
Yeah.
We'll be looking into its origins, its core ideas, how it spread so widely, and, well, why it eventually faded.
Yeah, the materials we're drawing from today really dig into Manichaeism. They shed light on its unique worldview and its interactions with other major religions and cultures. We've got sources defining its basic beliefs, the historical context, the life of its founder, Mani, the details of its doctrines, its, you know, syncretic nature, how it blended things, its scriptures, church structure, practices.
It's spread across the map.
Right. It spread, why it declined, and even its later influence in how we study it today. It's quite a lot.
Okay, so our aim today is to extract the most compelling insights, give you a clear sense of this religion of light and its significance, without getting totally bogged down in every single detail. We're hoping to uncover some maybe surprising facts and get a few aha moments along the way. All right, let's start at the beginning. Manichaeism, founded by the prophet Mani, 3rd century CE Persia, and it was right off the bat radically dualistic. What did that actually mean for them?
Fundamentally, it meant they saw reality as this constant, eternal battle between two completely separate forces. On one side, you have the world of light, good, spirit, the divine. On the other, the world of darkness, evil, matter. Co-eternal, uncreated, always in conflict.
So the universe itself is like a war zone.
Pretty much, yeah. A mixture, a battleground where these forces got tangled up. And crucially, they believed the human soul, our essence, was a particle of that divine light.
A particle of light.
Exactly. Trapped within the material world, the body, which they associated with darkness and evil.
That sounds, well, pretty bleak. How did they propose getting out of that trap?
It wasn't about standard religious rituals, really. Salvation came through gnosis.
Gnosis?
Yeah, a special kind of knowledge, a revealed understanding of these spiritual truths, your true origin in light, your entrapment in darkness. This knowledge was what could liberate the soul.
Interesting. Now, the sources mentioned it was often initially labeled a Christian heresy. Why was that?
That's a really important point. For a long time, especially in the West, it was seen that way. But modern scholarship generally agrees it was a distinct religion in its own right. It had its own founder, its own scriptures, its own church structure.
So why the heresy label?
Well, Mani did incorporate figures like Jesus into his system, calling him a great prophet. He even called himself an apostle of Jesus Christ. So for Christian opponents, especially as the church grew more powerful, it was convenient to frame Manichaeism as a kind of, you know, deviation, a corruption of the true faith.
Right, a way to delegitimize people like Augustine, who was actually Manichaean for a while.
Exactly. He later became a major critic and really pushed that heresy narrative. It shows the power dynamics at play.
But it clearly wasn't some small fringe group. The materials emphasize its impact.
Oh, absolutely not. For several centuries, it was huge. It spread incredibly widely, North Africa, Roman Empire, Persia, Central Asia, all the way to China. It was a serious rival to Christianity, Zoroastrianism, Buddhism. Studying it gives us amazing insights into, well, religious blending, competition, persecution, how ideas traveled the Silk Road.
It must have really struck a chord with people across different cultures. What made it so appealing, do you think?
The sources suggest a few things. It offered a pretty direct answer to that huge question. Why does evil exist? If you posit an equally powerful force of darkness, well, that explains it quite neatly. Plus, Mani was smart. He presented himself as the successor, the culmination of earlier prophets like Zoroaster, Buddha, Jesus. So he could appeal to people from those backgrounds.
So adaptability was key.
Definitely. And that radical dualism explaining evil seems to have been very compelling for many.
Ooh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roach Bosch. Hannah, let's see what she's brought us today. Ooh, this smells lovely. Really fragrant. Yes, this is a good brew today. Nice balance. Not too strong on the cardamom. Maybe just a touch more sugar for my taste, but honestly, very nice. Roach Bosch, Hannah. Thanks. Okay, where were we? Right, the appeal of Manichaeism. Now let's zoom in on the world it emerged from. Late antiquity. What was that religious environment like?
Mani was born in Parthian Babylonia, early 3rd century, and that place at that time was just buzzing with religious ideas. You had different forms of Christianity, Zoroastrianism, Buddhism spreading west, Hellenistic philosophy, Judaism, all interacting, influencing each other, a real melting pot.
Which encouraged syncretism, the blending of ideas.
Exactly, but then politically you had the rise of the Sasanian Empire during Mani's youth.
And they had their own agenda, right.
Yeah, they increasingly aimed to consolidate power around Zoroastrianism. So that created tension for other faiths, sometimes tolerance, sometimes suppression. Manichaeism arrived right in the middle of this vibrant but also competitive and politically charged scene.
So it was walking into a field with some pretty big players already established.
For sure. And its claims were universalist. This wasn't just a religion, it was presented as the ultimate universal truth, superseding the others. That naturally challenged the authority of the Christian Church, the Zoroastrian priesthood, the Sasanian state, later the Roman Empire.
And the Silk Road wasn't just for silk, was it? It played a big religious role, too.
Absolutely fundamental. Yeah. As Manichaeism spread east, it had to adapt. In Central Asia and China, for instance, they started using Buddhist and Taoist terms to explain their ideas, to make them resonate locally.
That flexibility sounds like a strength, but did it cause problems too? Like keeping everyone on the same page?
The sources do suggest that, yes. Trying to maintain doctrinal unity across such a huge, diverse area wasn't easy. That adaptability sometimes led to internal debates, even schisms down the line.
Okay, let's turn to the man himself, Mani, the Apostle of Light. Tell us about his background.
He was born April 14th, 216 CE, in southern Babylonia, part of the Parthian Empire then. His father, Potik, belonged to a group called the Elchisites.
Elchisites?
Yeah, a sort of Jewish Christian Baptist sect. Quite syncretic themselves, blending Jewish Christian Gnostic ideas. They focused on ritual washing, purification. Mani's mother, Miriam, apparently came from Parthian aristocracy.
So he grew up in this rather unique religious environment. We know details about this.
Some, yeah. The Cologne Mani Codex, an amazing find, gives us biographical details, likely with some, you know, saintly polishing about his youth in this Elchisite community.
It was during this time he had his key experiences.
Right. Tradition says he had two major revelations from his celestial twin, his Cyzicus, an angelic counterpart. The really decisive one came when he was 24, around 240 CE. This revelation basically gave him his mission: proclaim a new universal message and break away from the Elchisites.
Why the break? What was the fundamental disagreement?
It seems to boil down to vision. The Elchisites were probably more focused on their specific traditions. Mani felt he had a message for the entire world. He saw previous prophets, Zoroaster, Buddha, Jesus, as important but limited. Their messages may be corrupted over time. He was aiming for something bigger, more complete.
And this twin idea was crucial for his authority.
Absolutely. It positioned him not just as a wise teacher, but as someone divinely commissioned, directly linked to the realm of light, the seal of the prophets, the final messenger. That was a powerful claim.
So after that big revelation, he hit the road, basically, started spreading the word.
He did. His early journeys took him east, significantly into parts of India, Sindh, Tehran. There he encountered Buddhism, won followers, and importantly, started integrating some Buddhist ideas into his own system. Tradition even says he converted the local ruler, the Shah of Tehran.
And then back to Persia, where he actually got some official backing.
Yes, around 242 CE, he returned and managed to get an audience with the new Sasanian king, Shapur the Sun. Shapur didn't convert, but he gave Mani permission to preach throughout the empire. That was a huge boost early on. Mani even dedicated a major work, the Shaburagan, written in Middle Persian, directly to Shapur.
Was Shapur just being tolerant, or was there politics involved?
Likely a good dose of politics. Shapur ruled a diverse empire. A syncretic, universalist religion like Manichaeism might have seemed potentially useful for promoting some unity, appealing across different groups, without undermining Zoroastrianism completely. But that tolerance didn't last under later kings.
And Mani seems to have been very organized about this whole missionary effort.
Extremely. He sent out disciples systematically. He insisted on translating his writings into different languages. That was key for spreading it so far, so fast, west into the Roman Empire and east along the Silk Road. He was also an artist, a painter, and calligrapher. He created an illustrated book, the Arsang, to visually explain his complex ideas, especially for people who couldn't read.
And he wrote his core teachings down himself.
Yes, he deliberately wrote his main texts himself. He believed that's where earlier prophets went wrong. Their teachings got distorted because they relied on followers writing things down later. He wanted doctrinal purity from the start.
But that initial success and royal favor didn't last forever. Persecution followed, right? Even leading to his death.
Sadly, yes. The tolerance under Shapur Syaz and his immediate successor Hormizai was short-lived. The powerful Zoroastrian priesthood saw Manichaeism as a major threat. A high priest named Kartir became a particularly fierce opponent, pushing for Zoroastrian orthodoxy.
The Kartir gained influence.
He did. Under the next king, Baramas, who was heavily influenced by Kartir, Mani was arrested. He died in prison sometime between 274 and 277 CE. Manichaeans venerated his death as his passion, deliberately echoing Jesus' martyrdom. Some later stories claim he was flayed alive, but it's more likely he died in prison and his body was perhaps mutilated afterwards, maybe decapitated.
So his death was a turning point.
Definitely. It marked the start of serious, systematic persecution in the Sasanian Empire, driven by Kartir. But paradoxically, his martyrdom actually strengthened the faith for his followers. It became central to their story. And the persecution forced many Manichaeans to flee, which ironically helped spread the religion even further. They instituted the Bema Feast to commemorate his death annually.
Let's dive into those core beliefs. We mentioned dualism, but the materials call it a grand dualism. Can you unpack that a bit more?
It's the absolute foundation, an uncompromising eternal conflict between light and darkness. These aren't just abstract ideas. They're two co-eternal, uncreated, totally opposing realms. The realm of light, ruled by the Father of Greatness, peaceful, harmonious, perfect. It has its own specific spiritual qualities or attributes. The realm of darkness, ruled by the King of Darkness, no, not called God, inherently chaotic, aggressive, evil. It also has its own structure, its own negative attributes.
So totally separate origins for good and evil, not one creating the other.
Exactly. And the universe we experience is the messy result of darkness attacking light, causing them to mix. They had incredibly detailed descriptions of all the attributes of both realms. It shows a very systematic, almost scientific, Gnostic approach to mapping reality.
And this view directly addresses the problem of evil, doesn't it?
It really does. If evil is an independent, co-eternal power, then the good God isn't responsible for its existence. It offers a clear, logical answer to why there's suffering and darkness in a world supposedly created by good. That was a major part of its appeal.
How did they explain the actual creation of the universe, then, within this framework, the cosmic drama?
They described it in three times, past, present, future, the first time. Light and darkness existed separately, in total opposition. Then, the King of Darkness envied the light and attacked, the second time, that's now. The result of the attack is this mingling of light and darkness. Divine light particles are trapped in matter in us. The ongoing struggle is to free that light, the third time, the future. The ultimate final separation, all liberated light returns home, the material world is destroyed, and darkness is locked away forever.
And where does Primal Man fit into this story?
Ah, yes. So when darkness attacked, the Father of Greatness emanated the primal man, sometimes called Ormuzd Bey, to fight back. He was armed with his five sons, his light soul, basically. But Primal Man was overwhelmed, defeated, and his light elements were devoured by the forces of darkness, the Archon.
Defeat. That sounds bad.
Well, yes. But in their view, it was a necessary sacrifice. This fall was part of the divine plan, the event that actually caused the mingling, setting the stage for the whole cosmic rescue operation.
So our universe is basically built from the fallout of that battle.
In a way, yes. After Primal Man's fall, there was a second creation. Other divine beings used the captured light and the bodies of the defeated Archons to construct the physical universe, the heavens, the earth. The sun, moon, stars were seen as special vessels like cosmic fairies, collecting and transporting liberated light back to the realm of light.
And then humanity.
That was the third creation. Demonic forces, Archons named Ashqalan and Nebrol, created Adam and Eve from dark matter. But crucially, they trapped significant light particles within them. So humanity is this paradox. A body made by darkness, but containing a soul of divine light. Adam was even made in the image of a divine being, the third messenger, highlighting this contradiction.
Very different from the Genesis account.
Completely. The material body itself is seen negatively. And then Jesus, the splendor Yeshua, was sent.
To do what?
To awaken Adam, and by extension humanity, to their true nature. To impart the gnosis, the knowledge of their divine origin and how to escape. But in their view, Adam and Eve's sexual reproduction just kept trapping more light in new bodies, perpetuating the cycle.
So Jesus here is more of a revealer than a savior through sacrifice.
Exactly. A Gnostic revealer of knowledge, not an atoner for sin in the traditional Christian sense.
Okay, so if salvation is through this gnosis, this special knowledge, how did they believe people actually achieved it? How did the light get free?
It was about realizing your true identity, that spark of light within. The teachings of Mani and other messengers were the key to unlocking that realization. The goal was freeing those light particles from your own body, from the food you ate, which also contained trapped light, from the cosmos itself so they could return to the realm of light.
And how did that work in practice?
It involved following Mani's teachings, and especially for the elite group called the Elect, practicing strict asceticism.
Asceticism, like fasting and
Yes. fasting, strict vegetarianism, celibacy. The idea was that the elect, through their purity and specific dietary practices, could actually help liberate the light trapped in the food. They consumed food provided by the lay followers, the hearers. So the focus was on overcoming ignorance, not really sin in the usual sense. Ethical living and asceticism were the results of being awakened, not the means of earning salvation directly.
So the elect played a really central role.
Absolutely. They were the main engines of light liberation. The hearers supported them and hoped for a better reincarnation, a chance to become elect themselves, perhaps, and eventually achieve liberation, too.
What about the end of the game? What did Manichaeans believe happened after death and at the end of time? Eschatology.
Their eschatology was all about that final, absolute separation of light and darkness. What happened at death depended on your life. The truly righteous elect went straight to the paradise of light. Others, like hearers who weren't fully purified, or those still attached to matter, would be reincarnated for another chance.
And the very end.
The third time. It would start with a great cosmic war, a last judgment. All the remaining lights scattered in the universe would finally be gathered. Then, the entire physical cosmos would be consumed by a massive fire, lasting, according to some texts, a very specific 1,468 years. And finally, darkness itself, along with all the irredeemably evil beings, would be gathered up and sealed away forever in a kind of cosmic prison, sometimes called a bolus. Light and darkness would be separate again, eternally.
It's so clear how Manichaeism pulled threads from so many different places. The materials call it a syncretic tapestry.
Yeah.
What were the main ingredients in that blend?
Oh, it's a fascinating mix. You see clear influences from Zoroastrianism, various forms of Gnosticism, including Christian Gnosticism, mainstream Christianity itself, Buddhism, and even older Mesopotamian and Judaic traditions. And Manny deliberately presented his religion as the fulfillment, the perfection of these earlier partial truths. He saw himself as the final prophet, bringing the complete picture.
Let's take Zoroastrianism first, given the Persian context.
Big influence there, especially the cosmic dualism, the fight between good, Ahura Mazda, and evil, Angra Menu, the focus on light versus darkness, truth versus lie, and end-time scenarios. Manny arguably radicalized Zoroastrian dualism by making the two principles absolutely co-eternal. He sometimes framed his message to appeal to the Sasanians, almost like a reformed Zoroastrianism. But that idea of evil being just as eternal as good was a fundamental challenge to Zoroastrian orthodoxy, where Ahura Mazda is ultimately supreme. That caused friction.
And the Christian and Gnostic strands were obviously huge, too.
Absolute fundamental. The whole Gnostic package is there. The radical split between the high God and a flawed material world, the divine spark trapped in matter, salvation through secret knowledge, gnosis, often a ascetic view of Christ, meaning he only appeared human, and ascetic practices. Manny called himself Apostle of Jesus Christ. His background in the Elchisite sect exposed him directly to these Jewish Christian Gnostic currents.
But their Jesus was different, wasn't he?
Yes. Primarily Jesus the Splendor, the revealer of Gnosis, not the sacrificial lamb of mainstream Christianity. You also see echoes of St. Paul, maybe in the idea of apostleship or the inner conflict between spirit and flesh. Manichaeism has been called, you know, the most organized and widespread form of Gnosticism.
And Buddhism, especially as it moved east.
A major influence, particularly after Manny's travels to India. You see concepts like suffering, dukkha, reincarnation, samsara, liberation, similar to nirvana, the ideal of a monastic community like the Buddhist Sangha, ethics like nonviolence, the idea of reincarnation for impure souls fits well. The elixir structure mirrors the monk's laity distinction. In the East, Manny was sometimes even called a Buddha, the Buddha of light. Texts found in Central Asia freely use Buddhist terms.
Wow. And what about older Mesopotamian or Judean? Roots.
You see influences in their complex angelology and demonology, all the beings involved in the cosmic drama. Also in creation myths and apocalyptic ideas, like drawing on the traditions in the Book of Enoch, which shows up in their Book of Giants. Manny's Elchisite upbringing brought in those Baptist elements. There might even be echoes of older Babylonian cosmology. Ritual things, too, like using perfumed oils and incense, probably picked up local influences.
It's incredible how he wove all that together. And central to holding it together were their scriptures. They really emphasized written text, didn't they?
Massively important. Manny insisted on writing the core texts himself, believing that's how previous religions got corrupted, teachings weren't properly recorded by the founders. He produced a canon, often called the Manichaean Heptateuch, 7 major works, mostly written first in Syriac. Things like the Living Gospel, the Treasury of Life, the Book of Mysteries, the Book of Giants, his epistles, psalms and prayers.
And the Shaburgan for the king, and the illustrated Arzang.
Exactly. The Shaburigen in Middle Persian and the Arzang, the Book of Pictures, using art to teach. He really pushed for translation, too, wanting his message accessible everywhere.
What were these main books generally about?
Well, the Living Gospel laid out the core teachings. Treasury of Life dealt with the soul, the cosmos. Pragmatia was about their view of history and the cosmic fight. Book of Mysteries focused on the soul's fate. Book of Giants adapted Enochic stories. The epistles were letters clarifying things, psalms and prayers for worship. Each served a specific function in building the whole picture.
And other texts developed later.
Oh, yes. We have collections like the Kephaliah chapters or discourses of Mani found in Coptic, lots of hymn cycles, parables for teaching, stories about Mani's life like the Cologne Mani Codex. And the sheer range of languages these texts are found in is stunning. Syriac, Middle Persian, Parthian, Sogdian, Coptic, Chinese, Uyghur, Greek, Latin. It really shows their spread and their effort to translate and adapt.
This focus on scripture must have influenced how they organized themselves as a community. What was the Manichaean church structure like?
It was clearly hierarchical, with two main groups, the elect and the hearers.
Okay, the elect first. Who were they? What did they do?
They were the spiritual core, the elite. They lived a very strict ascetic life dedicated to achieving gnosis and helping liberate light. They were the ones who followed the really demanding rules.
Like the vegetarianism and celibacy.
Exactly. Plus rules about truthful speech, not harming any life because it contained light, poverty. These were often summarized as the three seals of the mouth, hands, and breast. They believed their pure bodies and specific vegetarian diet, provided by the hearers, actually helped release light particles trapped in the food. They often lived as traveling missionaries or in monastic-style communities. Becoming elect involved a special initiation, the consolamentum.
And the hearers, the larger group.
Right, the lay followers. They lived more ordinary lives in society. They could marry, work, own property. Their main religious duty was supporting the elect, giving them food, clothing, shelter. They had their own ethical code, usually 10 commandments, less strict than the elect's. They participated in prayers, hymns, confession. Their hope was that by supporting the elect and living virtuously, they'd get a better reincarnation and eventually reach liberation themselves.
A very symbiotic relationship then. What about shared rituals?
They had daily prayers, often facing the sun or moon, regular fasting periods, communal confession ceremonies, like the Ex-Wust-One-Eft found in Turkic texts. Singing hymns was very important. The ritual meal for the elect was central to the light liberation idea, and their biggest annual festival was the Bema Feast, remembering Mani's martyrdom.
And art was clearly more than just decoration for them.
Absolutely integral, right from Mani himself being a painter. The discoveries, especially from Turfan and Dinhuang on the Silk Road, show this amazing artistic tradition. We have stunning illuminated manuscripts, painted silk banners, wall paintings, textiles. The themes are often the cosmic battle, portraits of Mani or other figures, diagrams of the cosmos, scenes of paradise or judgment, always with that strong symbolism of light.
These were teaching tools as well.
Yes, didactic, but also used in worship, for devotion. Beautifully made things, clearly highly valued. They combined artistic styles from all the cultures they encountered, Persian, Indian, Hellenistic, Chinese, and they even used things like perfume and incense, creating a whole sensory environment for their practices.
Let's trace that journey now. It started in Mesopotamia, but went incredibly far. Westward first.
Yeah, it moved quickly into the Roman Empire, probably by the late 3rd century. Egypt, North Africa, where Augustine encountered it, Rome itself, Gaul, Spain. It clearly had appeal there, but it ran into heavy opposition from the Roman state, especially once Christianity became dominant, and fierce condemnation from the church. Persecution was often intense, and by the 6th century or so, it was largely wiped out in the West.
And back in its Persian homeland, it wasn't smooth sailing there either after the initial period.
No. After Shapur I, later Sasanian kings and the increasingly powerful Zoroastrian clergy cracked down hard. It was seen as a dangerous heresy. Communities survived, sometimes underground, for centuries. But then, under the Abbasid Caliphate, after the Islamic conquest, there was renewed persecution of Zindiq heretics, which often included Manichaeans. Their center of power eventually had to shift east, Samarkand, by the 10th century.
But eastward along the Silk Road, that seems to be where it really thrived for a long time.
That was its stronghold for centuries. Sogdian merchants were key early on, carrying it across Central Asia. It flourished in oasis cities, the Tarim Basin. The huge turning point was the conversion of the ruler of the Uyghur Khaganate in the 760s. Manichaeism became the state religion for about a century. That was a golden age, temples built, texts copied and translated, art produced.
But that didn't last forever either.
No. The Uyghur Khaganate fell in 840 CE. That was a major blow. Manichaeism survived in the Tarim Basin communities for several more centuries, but its political protection was gone. It eventually faded there too, especially with the Mongol invasions later on. And there were internal splits in the east as well.
And China. It made it all the way there.
It did, arriving probably late 6th, early 7th century. It got official, the restricted recognition, for a while. It really benefited from the Tang Dynasty's alliance with the Manichaean Uyghurs. Temples were even built in major Chinese cities like Chang'an. But after the Uyghurs fell in 840, the hammer came down in China too. Major persecution drove it underground.
Did it disappear completely?
Not immediately. It survived, especially in southern China, by blending in even more with local traditions, particularly Buddhism and Taoism. It became known as Mingzhou, the religion of light. It sometimes got caught up in peasant uprisings, which led to more suppression. By the 17th century, it seems to have largely vanished as a separate, organized religion, though maybe some ideas were absorbed into folk beliefs. We have amazing late evidence, though, like the Cowan Temple and Pujian, and recently discovered manuscripts from Shapu showing its long persistence.
So, despite this incredible spread, it eventually declined almost everywhere. What were the main reasons it ultimately faded away?
It seems to be a combination of factors. Number one is relentless, sustained persecution from dominant powers, Roman, Persian, Chinese, and established religions like Christianity, Zoroastrianism, Islam, Buddhism. Competition was fierce. These other religions often had stronger state backing, more established institutions.
Anything internal?
Possibly. The very strict lifestyle demanded of the elect might have limited its mass appeal compared to faiths with easier paths for laypeople. Maybe the hierarchy felt too exclusive to some. And just the difficulty of holding together such a vast, diverse network across centuries, maintaining unity, that's always a challenge. By the late Middle Ages, it was mostly gone as a living, organized force.
But its ideas didn't vanish without a trace. There's talk of later influences, a legacy.
Definitely. That core dualistic idea, the world as a battleground between good and evil, light and darkness, kept echoing. The term Manichaean itself became, a negative label thrown at groups seen as dualistic or heretical by mainstream Christianity.
Like the Cathars in medieval Europe.
Exactly. Groups like the Paulicians in Byzantium, the Bogomils in the Balkans, the Cathars or Albigensians in southern France, they were often accused of Manichaeism. The direct historical links are complex and debated by scholars, but the parallels in dualistic thinking are certainly there. Some scholars also suggest subtle influences on things like Islamic mysticism, Sufism, or certain ascetic traditions in Christianity and Islam. The Gnostic elements within Manichaeism kept resurfacing in different ways. Its impact on how people thought about good and evil was profound.
It's incredible that for so long we mostly knew about it from its enemies' writings, but modern discoveries have changed everything.
Completely revolutionized the field. For centuries, we had Augustine, Zoroastrian polemics, Islamic heresiographers, all biased. Then, starting mainly in the early 20th century, came the archaeological finds. Texts from Kellis in Egypt, the huge hall from the Turfan Oasis in China, finds from Dunhuang on the Silk Road, and more recently, those Yapu manuscripts in southern China. Suddenly, we had Manichaean texts in their own words in multiple languages.
What have these finds told us?
So much. Kellis gave us a glimpse into the everyday life, the lived religion, of a community in Egypt. Turfan provided masses of material scriptures, hymns, letters, art, crucial for understanding its Eastern forms and its interactions with Buddhism. Dunhuang showed how it adapted in China, blending with Taoism and Buddhism. Jiaku reveals its surprising late survival and unique Chinese features, like venerating Yishu, their version of Jesus.
And this has led to a whole academic field focused on Manichaeism.
Absolutely. There have been pioneering scholars decoding and interpreting these texts. There's an International Association of Manichaean Studies, IAMS, bringing researchers together. There's a huge project, the Corpus Fontium Manichaeorum, CFM, aiming to publish all the source texts properly. Journals like Gnosis publish ongoing research. It's a very active field, constantly refining our understanding.
So our exploration today really highlights what a complex and, frankly, amazing religious tradition Manichaeism was. It held sway over this vast area for centuries. From that stark dualism the way it wove together different faiths, the structure of the elect and hearers. It really gives us a unique insight into the religious world of antiquity in the early Middle Ages.
And the fact that we can now read their own words, thanks to those discoveries, lets us move beyond the hostile accounts. We can appreciate its intellectual depth, its artistic expression, and why it appealed so strongly to people wrestling with those fundamental questions of good and evil, light and darkness.
When you think about the world it grew up in, that incredible mix of cultures and ideas, you can see how it both flourished and faced challenges. And seeing echoes of its dualism later on makes you think, doesn't it? About how persistent that human search for explaining good versus evil really is. Maybe the religion of light, even though it's gone as a major force, still has things to teach us, still illuminates parts of our own ongoing search for meaning.